Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter.
You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations, which is aired on the third Tuesday of each month from 2 until 3 p.m. on WGXC Acre 90.7 FM.
On each show, invited guests will be asked to discuss a number of items that they intend taking with them on their Catskill Cabin getaway. As we discuss their chosen items, it is hoped that you, the listener, will enjoy getting to know that person a little bit better.
Today's guest is Elizabeth Henry. Elizabeth is a Jersey girl who obtained a bachelor's degree in English literature from a women's college in Pennsylvania. In years gone by, she worked as an assistant to Helen Gurley Brown at Cosmopolitan magazine and at Random House, Young and Rubicam, Grey Advertising and the Soho News in Manhattan. She writes and acts because she loves to. Elizabeth is also fascinated by the United States Constitution, and she is hopelessly in love with her husband and children. Ah, Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andy.
So, what women's college in Pennsylvania did you graduate from?
Cedar Crest College.
Cedar Crest?
Cedar Crest.
Cedar Crest.
Yes. Right, okay. It's one of the first women's colleges in this nation, and it's near Lehigh University, Lafayette College, Muhlenberg College, and shares a lot of traditions with Franklin and Marshall.
And what did you major in?
English literature, right, for the most part, but I did a lot of writing there.
Right.
There wasn't a creative writing major. And I got a degree. I'm certified to teach, but it wasn't anything I ever pursued, so I kind of never mentioned that.
Right. And do you have any aspirations to write a book, short stories, poems, or anything like that?
Well, currently I write for the Woodstock Times. I write for their special section articles. I'm given random topics and I write about them. It's not hard news reporting. It's not interviews, although I love interviewing. And I also have written two screenplays and a stage play, and I have a novel that I've completed. But I'm always tweaking these things. I'm not a good business person. I'm terrible at self-promotion, and I'm not good at trying to make connections to get my stuff published. I just love doing it. But and I also have written a children's book that's kind of a long-form children's book in the style of Harry Potter. It's not an illustrated book for toddlers. It's
Excellent. Course, yeah. Would you be able to share the genre of your novel?
Sure. The novel that I wrote is called Birdie and the Beast, and it's about a young woman who comes of age in the mountains in a very small community that is being threatened with extinction due to big political forces. And so she grows up with a very special knowledge about the earth and things that grow and wildness. And she's going to be forced to make a choice to stay there where there will be very few people or leave and make a new life for herself. And then a man.
It's always a man, isn't it? It's always a man.
What's the literary term for that?
It's always his fault, and he was a skier.
Happiness.
Was he a skier by any chance?
No, he's a forest ranger.
Oh, right. Oh, well, don't tell us what happened. We'll find out when we read it.
I look forward to reading it once it gets published.
Okay. And now, I wrote a play about Maude Adams, who is the foremost American actress in the 1900s. She was the first Peter Pan. And her estate is right here on the mountain.
Wow.
It still exists.
And you wrote a book about her?
A play.
A play.
And a screenplay.
Right. And has it seen the light of day?
Not yet. There's been readings of it. I haven't pushed it. I'm just not good at that. And I'm always like redoing stuff.
Push, goddammit, push!
I know.
Do you have any kids?
Yeah.
Well, you know how to push. Come on.
Good heavens, man.
I know.
Now, tell us a bit about Cosmopolitan magazine. How did you manage to wrangle a job in there?
I tell you, I walked off the street, got an interview, and got hired.
Now, wait a minute. Now, Mike, we've interviewed people in the past. Oh, I was just walking down the street in Manhattan, and somebody said, do you want to go to work with me in the Jacksons?
Yeah, that did happen.
You know, this doesn't happen. People just walking down the street in Manhattan, they get a job. Yeah. Cosmopolitan magazine, does it?
It did happen, though. It really did. It really did. And no one was more surprised than I was. But she was a fabulous boss. She was very, very, very professional.
This being Helen Gurley Brown.
Helen Gurley Brown. Very right. professional, very kind, very witty. She was
editor-in-chief for 32 years.
Yeah.
So she was a powerful woman.
And she was very hands-on, and she took tremendous responsibility for everything. She was lovely.
Now, the Constitution, what is it about the Constitution that you're fascinated by?
Well, because it seems to me the epitome of advanced intellectual thought so far in our human civilization, having to do with liberty and freedom and the responsibilities that go along with that.
Yeah, and that's always has been, probably always will be, a contentious issue in terms of what really is, how do we constitute freedom and liberty and democracy.
Mm-hmm. It is a work of genius, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's simple, a little bit complex, but brilliant in that, you know, the saying is that the Constitution was written by geniuses so that the government could be run by idiots.
Right.
And years ago, I went to a conference and met a young woman from France who was on kind of like an exchange teaching program. And she was going to school to learn about French government. And she was complimenting the United States government and how great it was and how it's really admired by the French. And I was like, really? I kind of was getting the impression, and this is years ago, earlier in the war in Iraq, so America wasn't terribly popular. And I was like, I thought there's a little friction there between the French and the Americans. And she said, well, that's true, but we still love your government. And I was like...
Yeah, culturally, I think that's true. But I think everyone envies what we accomplished governmentally. Culturally, that's always the case. But it's what makes America... I lived in Sweden, and everyone extols Sweden as this great place to live. But I got to tell you... Not so much.
It's expensive.
It's tremendously expensive. And when I lived there...
Pint of beer, please. That'll be £25.
There's a great series by Stephen Fry. It's called Stephen Fry in America. And he goes through each of the 50 states in a black cab. And
a Hackney.
What is it called?
A Hackney cab.
A Hackney cab.
Black cab.
A black cab, yeah.
Black hack.
And so he goes all over America, and he says the same things kind of that we're saying now, that everything in America is just kind of big and out of control. He goes to this football game in the South at a college, and it was like Auburn University versus Alabama, I think. It's a game they have every year, and he just...
big time.
And talks about it. And the great defining moment is that after, you know, the Americans sing God Bless America, it's this really teary moment, and then fighter jets fly over. And it's this is just a football game. It's not even major universities.
Yes, right. Yeah.
And his expression after that, he's just like, what is going on?
Well, it's not a major university to him, but that's big time football. Alabama? Yeah. Mm-mm.
Yeah. Elizabeth, your first song is I Only Have Eyes for You by the Flamingos.
Mm-hmm.
Why this song?
Well, it's sort of an early rock and roll hit, and there's a romance and an eroticism in it that's kind of missing in today's music. Certainly, well, it just is, and I just think that for back when that song was a hit, the people that were listening to it were young, you know, 15 or 16 years old, and to have that be an expression for them must have been very important, because you know, sex was still a whisper, it was taboo. But it's what, very erotic and beautiful. So and I love rock and roll. My mentor as a writer was one of the first rock and roll songwriters, and I used to write about music for the Soho News. So anyway, that just song just typifies something special for me.
It's been played on television shows and in movies, and when I think of this song, I think of the dark gymnasium or ballroom with the disco ball and the light, speckly lights everywhere, and
before
people slow
disco
dancing.
Balls.
Yes.
There were no disco balls.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some the teachers would come and make you not dance so close. And
And actually, I found out that Pepsi Company was sued for having used the song in a 1998 television commercial without having consulted them.
Mm-hmm.
The genre of music is doo-wop, I guess.
Doo-wop, doo-wada.
Yeah, and so you have this kind of high tenor and then a low bass underneath it.
Yeah. There seems to be a theme about that. We'll talk about that in a wee while.
My love must be a kind of blind love. I can't see anyone but you.
I Only Have Eyes For You by the Flamingos. Now, Elizabeth, your first item is a lock of your horse's hair.
And I should have said a lock of, when you asked me about this, a lock of my horse's hair wound around my first dog's collar, because the dogs and horses are a big part of my life.
Right. And what is the name of this horse?
His name is Thumper.
And is Thumper still with us?
Yep, he's 32.
Wow! Impressive. Horses, I read that horses are really only supposed to live to around age 25. Mm-hmm. And I think the world record horse named Old Billy from, I think he lived in England, was maybe 58 or 68, around 60 years old. That's incredible. So yeah. What's your secret?
I think he just has had a good life. He's a stallion, and he did not live with the herd because we didn't want baby horses all over the place, but he could see the girls. So a lot of what a stallion does.
So is it, you're saying the secret to long life in horses is frustration?
Well, that perhaps he's just such a good stallion. It's just it's such a good, you know, like he definitely got the job done. He sired a lot of foals, but he was a wonderful trail horse and a wonderful show horse. He did a lot of winning, but he didn't like it. He loved the trail. If he would move the way he did on the trail in a show, he would have been absolutely unbeatable. But he would behave. He was a very well-mannered stallion, and he always behaved in the show ring, but he wasn't brilliant. But
when you say the show ring, do you mean show jumping?
He wasn't a jumper. He was a saddle seat horse.
Right.
So he was just brilliant out on the trail. I mean, he would just like puff up, like just come up like you're riding a motorcycle, you know, and right. just move, you know, motor down. He just loved it. He just loved to be out there.
Do you feed him certain stuff?
Well, now, because one of the things that happens with old horses is their teeth begin to go. So he gets two huge buckets of mush. We cook for him twice a day.
Wow. What's in the mush?
Beet pulp, senior feed, a type of sweet feed that's safe for his gut. And in the winter, we still give him cracked corn, although there's a lot of, I guess, scientific evidence that you shouldn't feed them corn. The old farmers thought that it was good. It helped heat them up, give them warmth. Well, we give it to him. He likes it. And that's the mush. And bran, a nice hot bran mash when it's real cold.
Right.
That keeps him. You do that because sometimes he's one of them. Sometimes horses don't like to drink very cold water.
Right.
And if they don't have enough water intake, they'll colic. They'll get blocked because they can't burp.
I watch The Incredible Dr. Saul or Paul, and he works in big animals, and you see sometimes horses have colic, and they put this tube down their throat and then put hot water in, and it helps them to be sick, you know, or that.
It looks
like a brutal thing to do, but it's obviously necessary. But when I see it, I'm like, oh, poor horse. But then if it don't do it, the horse could die.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And so we give him the hot bran mash because that's a way for him to get a lot of liquid. It's just like eating really soupy oatmeal.
Right.
But he's getting the liquid in there and keeps him regular.
Well, let's hope he's kicking, alive and kicking in 10 years, you know?
Yeah, we'll
Given
see.
That oldest horse in the world's a run for its money.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Now, Elizabeth, sorry to interrupt you, Mike. On you go.
Well, I just wanted to say, do you guys know what the speed record is for a horse?
I think 40 miles an hour.
40 miles an hour, Andy?
43 miles an hour.
55 miles
55.
An hour.
Wow.
55 and still alive.
Can you imagine falling off the horse?
Oh my! Well, yeah, game over, I guess.
Yeah, game. That's game over, isn't it?
Now, was that clocked a thoroughbred race or an Arab or what? What?
It's probably Seabiscuit or something.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't read the breed and all the specifics. It was just that statistic.
Yeah. Have you ever fallen off a horse?
Oh yeah, plenty of times.
Yeah.
Sore. Yeah, it hurts. Yeah. It hurts.
That's when you need. Are we read it your Bible?
Yeah, that's right.
Which is your next item? Mike's got me in training for lap dissolve into
transition.
Transition,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
So your next item is your Bible.
I started reading the Bible late in life. I'm not a churchgoer, and I wasn't raised in a particularly religious home, but I think it's definitely the Holy Bible. It's definitely imbued
as opposed to the unholy Bible.
Yeah, and it's beautiful, and you know, from as literature, it's beautiful, but also, you know, the wisdom in it and the history, and it's just a fascinating.
You know, I was reading about it. Sorry to interject there.
That's it.
Yeah. I was reading this thing, and it's quite an interesting thing that I found. It's quite an amazing book. Now, incredibly, there are no contradictions in the Bible, right?
Huh.
Various people claim to find contradictions, but they have to take verses out of context to do so.
Hmm.
When looking at the Bible as a whole and understanding its teachings, there are no contradictions. This is amazing when one considers that the Bible was written over such a long period of time.
And when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls...
which I've seen.
Wow.
In Glasgow, a museum.
That they were true to what's in the Bible. It's just amazing. It's an amazing piece.
Despite centuries of translation and centuries of transcription, that the wording can be so identical.
Right. Word of God. So it is. It's just really, really fascinating. And I'm always questioning. I'm not dogmatic in my beliefs, and I certainly love hearing about faith, you know, everyone's faith or everyone's doubt. But I do value the Bible.
I think that the Bible at face value is about love and about forgiveness and understanding and empathy. I think that's the key message. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes people get tripped up when they want to make the Bible maybe a science manual, or they want to follow all the legalities, all the rules, and that's when it's like, oh golly, Jesus, this book of Leviticus is pretty rough, you know?
And it is, but that was the Christ came to say, that's all fine and good, but really... Really, you're just supposed to love each other.
Yeah.
You know, like when those rules start to get in the way of you loving each other, maybe you should take a second look. So, and that's really hard to do. It's you know, simple, but very hard to do.
There are...
For me, anyway, I'm a hopeless sinner.
There are more than 1,680 Bibles sold in America or given away.
Well...
Each day.
I know a man, a very, very gentle fellow and an academic... You'd never know that he was sort of like a secret agent, but he would risk... It is a crime to distribute Bibles in China.
Yeah.
And he does that.
Wow.
You'd never believe... You'd never believe that this was a big risk taker and stuff, but he's just this...
And you've just outed him.
And his name is...
No! Next song...
Dear.
Which is Amazing Grace,
mm-hmm.
sung by Mahalia Jackson.
Yeah.
Why that song, Elizabeth?
When I was a little girl, my parents listened to all different kinds of music, and my mother loved that song. And my mother was this tiny little Scot Welsh Irish woman, really, really tiny. And she had this little reedy voice. And if you listen to Mahalia Jackson's voice, it's not that at all. But my mother would sing along to it. And it just touched me somehow. And Amazing Grace is a beautiful song. So.
And she's got a great voice, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's such soul, isn't
yeah.
it? She was the queen of gospel, mm-hmm. as they called her.
Yep.
But she was very big into the civil war, mm-hmm.
civil rights
yep. movement and yep. women's rights and stuff yep. like that. Worked very closely with Jackson and others, and
she really was very loving. You know, there was no hate. Yeah. It was her life was about love.
Ah.
That was Amazing Grace, sung by Mahalia Jackson. You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations on WGXC Acra, 90.7 FM. Today we have Elizabeth Henry talking about some of these songs and items that she would take on a weekend getaway to the Catskill Mountains.
Now, I want to correct myself. I mentioned Jackson when I was talking about civil rights and movement. Mm-hmm. Although Jesse Jackson was involved as well, I meant to say Martin Luther King Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Martin Luther King Jr. asked her to join at the Montgomery, Alabama protests that were happening around about the time, in, I think it was the 50s, and she agreed, and she did, you know, some of that, concerts and stuff like that to raise money for funds for the all of that, for the, you know, the protest and to get things overturned and stuff like that. However, I want to read this bit to you, which I think is quite interesting.
Hmm.
At the March of Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963, Jackson performed "I Been Booked and I Been Scorned" before King gave his "I Have a Dream" speech. Towards the end of the speech, he departed from his prepared text for a partly improvised preoration on the theme "I Have a Dream," prompted by Jackson's cry, "Tell them about the dream, Martin." Mm. So I wonder if you could, if you listen closely, you could hear her in the background shouting that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But she played a big part in all that.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And she didn't really get her due as a vocalist the way that subsequent Black American singers have.
Aretha Franklin comes to mind.
Aretha Franklin didn't have the gravitas at the time of her big hits that she has now. And I think what ushered in the appreciation for those women and that style of singing was the play Dreamgirls. And I, when I worked in Manhattan, I interviewed those women. And
when you worked for Cosmopolitan?
No, when I worked for the Soho News.
Right.
It was more than just a, you know, like a terrifically entertaining. It really represented a tipping point in our appreciation of the contributions of our African American fellow citizens.
Now, obviously, Mahalia Jackson played a big part in her life, was in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
One of your first bosses, Helen Gurley Brown, is from Alabama. So
yeah.
I wondered if she had a wee influence in the type of music you liked.
Oh, no, my influences really, it started with my parents, and then it's just something, you know, some people develop, and I come from a very working class family. I mean, my father was a fine finished carpenter. He wasn't a union carpenter. He was a carpenter who, he could build a house himself if he had to, but mostly he did really beautiful furniture and stuff like that. But he was a carpenter, and my mother was a proofreader. They were very, very simple people. And some people that I know that I grew up with, you know, at the time that I grew up, there was a lot of opportunity and people became professionals, and they developed a taste for art and buying art and appreciating art. And I do kind of, but I really developed a feeling for music just because it's, but certainly Helen Gurley Brown did not influence me whatsoever.
Elizabeth, did you ever see the movie The Devil Wears Prada?
Oh yeah, sure.
Can you connect with that in any way?
Oh sure, it was based on Anna Wintour, who is a difficult woman.
Mm.
But a lot of very, very successful people are difficult. They're exacting, and they just don't suffer fools gladly. I wouldn't have liked to work for her. Helen Gurley Brown was nothing like that.
Yeah.
Nothing. And we worked, there were 12 people on our staff. If you look at the masthead of Cosmopolitan now, I don't know what they're doing. There's like hundreds. I don't know what they're doing. Yeah. So, That and that world is very. My daughter works in that world, and it's a tough world to be in. Fashion, right. Cosmopolitan had a fashion department, but was not a fashion magazine.
So you can't really relate to Anne Hathaway's character in The Devil Wears Prada, I would assume.
No, only in that I did not want to work for a woman's magazine. Like, I wanted to work for the New York Times, but I didn't have the connections and I didn't have the resume. I had nothing going for me.
Well, you didn't walk down the right street, because obviously if you walked down the right street at the right time, somebody would say, hey, you want a job in the New York Times?
Yeah,
so
maybe.
Maybe your experience in Cosmopolitan, you can't connect with the actress Anne Hathaway, but as a writer, you could connect with Anne Hathaway, the wife of William Shakespeare.
Yes.
The complete works of which is another item you're bringing to the your cabin in the Catskills.
Yeah. I love
You're showing off now.
I love Shakespeare. It's not easy to read. It's not the kind of thing that should be taught in schools by reading it. The kids should kind of act it out.
I agree.
You know,
yeah.
And they should be, the teachers should be allowed to simplify the language a bit so that they get to the action of what it is.
Take political license.
Yeah, but it is beautiful. It's just beautiful writing, and I do love it. And it has to do with acting, which I also love.
Yeah. Have you acted in a Shakespeare?
Yes. I was Titania and Hippolyta in A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Ooh. Have you ever done anything like Macbeth or anything like that?
No, I haven't. That would be a really difficult role for me to do, Lady Macbeth, because she's just so awful. but it's a great role at the same time.
But you're an actor, Elizabeth. Yeah, can do awful.
I mean, you'd really get to show your chops, you know, in a role like that. Yeah.
Lady Macbeth. At least it's not Hamlet. Hamlet is one of those roles that you cannot do successfully, right?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, a Hamlet was a cigar.
Oh,
there's a cigar called Hamlet in Britain.
Were they made in Denmark and were they rotten?
We're frozen.
That's how good my education was when I was in school. I didn't know what Hamlet was.
Yeah, mine too.
Mike, have you ever done any Shakespeare?
Yeah, I was in King Lear in college, as well as the Comedy of Errors. In the Comedy of Errors, I played Adriana, the jealous housewife, and it was done in a Korean mask dance style.
Fabulous.
A lot of cross-gendered roles there. So I played a woman, and the husband character was played by a woman.
Did it come easy to you?
Yeah. No. It was a very challenging. But, you know, part of the comedy of it was that you would have this kind of big masculine wife pining after this kind of feminine husband, and it was that quirkiness that really kind of
gender roles reversal and stuff like that.
King Lear, that was set in Mongolia. That was awesome, a lot of fun. But that like any of Shakespeare's tragedies, the tragedies are just
tragic.
They're marathons of emotional, rough
roller coasters.
And there's no, it's a tragedy. It just ends. Everyone dies. Yeah. Horrible things. Yeah. And I was also in Julius Caesar in Delaware Park in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. So I've had a little experience with Shakespeare, and you're right. The language is so hard, and it's a real turnoff to people. And I think sometimes, you know, classically in schools, they teach the iambic pentameter. So you read it and it's like, you have to follow this beat. And that's not really what's intended.
Right.
And I think if it's acted well, it's really entertaining and hilarious to follow. And the jokes, you know, Shakespeare was the 16th century version of South Park or Family Guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think basically the type of humor. And
yeah.
I remember in the Comedy of Errors, there's basically a fart scene where somebody lets out this epic fart to try to knock down a door. And we had a Korean band there doing these like sound effects. And, you know.
Did it work?
Oh, it was hilarious. Yeah, the door didn't come down, no. But
You know, I've been in schools and I've been like substitute teaching years ago for English teachers, and it's like, right, okay, we're halfway through Macbeth, you know, and there's these kids sitting there and they don't have any idea
what's been
read or said. And I'll be honest with you, a lot of the times I was the same, and I'm saying to myself, right, I'm supposed to be an intellectual guy.
Hmm.
far more educated than these kids, and I don't understand. What chance have they got of understanding this? Let's simplify it for the kids so they can at least make a choice whether they want to take part or not. And right at this point, they then have a choice. They couldn't take part because half the kids couldn't read anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's another reason why I chose Shakespeare, because I have two profoundly dyslexic children, and they were such a gift to me because I'm such a wordy person, and to explore how brains are different and how differ and how talent is in there and abilities are in there, and it's very, very difficult. I took my children out of public school. It's like a big beef with me. I think the public schools could do so much more. They're just not open to it.
Mm. Did you homeschool them?
No, they went to the Bruderhof for 5 years, and then
that a bar in Wyndham?
The Bruderhof. Well, it used to be. Now they're called the Catskill Community, right? The Catterskill Community, or something. They change their names all the time. But it's a community based, faith based group of people. And they have communities here. They have them all over the United States, all over the world, really. And they approach teaching reading through the Orton-Gillingham method of teaching reading, which was developed in England.
Right.
And it's specifically for, it's phonetic, and it's specifically for dyslexics, and it works. And I don't know why the public schools won't adopt it. They just won't.
Yeah.
And they think that the Wilson program will work, and it won't. My son was accepted into a fabulous program in Scotia, which is a town west of Schenectady, called the Special Literacy Program. It's all Orton, all the time, everything. And that's where he really got a really good grounding in language arts. And both of those kids are college graduates. Both of them are doing very, very well. Both of them feel as if they belong. And that's the crime of not treating dyslexia, is the children know that they can't do what comes so easily to others, because it's a neurological ability that starts in the womb. And when you can't do it when you're in fourth grade and everybody else can, you begin to think you're stupid.
Yeah, there's a problem. Yeah.
But you're not stupid. It's a neurological difference. One woman, Margaret Mabee, who's a professor at SUNY Ulster, said to me, she said, "What I'm going to say is going to shock you, Mrs. McCary, but your children would be better off if they were blind." And what she meant by that was, if they were blind, they'd have a Braille literate teacher's aide by law with them at all times. But because they're not blind, they're dyslexic, they get nada. So, but they've done very well, and we're very grateful for we were really guided by something way bigger than us, and we were very lucky.
Well, I'd love to talk more about that, but we can't. We need to move on.
Sorry.
No, because I wrote a paper on dyslexia, so I'll speak to you about it later. But we need to move on to our next song, and it's Please Excuse My Pronunciation If I Get It Wrong, but it's O Mio Babbino Caro.
Right. Caro.
Caro.
Yeah.
Sung by, who's it sung by?
Anna Netrebko.
I got you to say that, yeah, see that?
Anna Netrebko.
Yeah.
I don't know why I say that. Well, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. Actually, I don't really know that much about opera, but I saw this woman perform last year with the Russian guy whose name is very hard to
say.
Dmitry Voroskovsky. He, last August, was diagnosed with a brain tumour.
Oh.
And he had to take time off, and then he made his comeback.
Oh, good.
And I went to see the live beam back from the Met, and I saw it in the Bardavon Theatre. And the woman who was singing, I thought, when I came out, I was like, she's fantastic. What a voice. It made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. And it was Anna
Netrebko. Latvian or Ukrainian?
Russian. But she was Russian, but she's also Swiss or Swedish citizenship as well. So.
But she sang a duet that's called the Flower Duet from Lakme, which is absolutely gorgeous. But this has special meaning to me, so that's why.
What is the meaning of the song to you?
My daughter, my dyslexic daughter,
uh-huh.
has a voice, I dare say, as good as Anna Netrebko's. Ooh. And was classically trained. She won't sing anymore because she had a bad high school teacher.
Oh.
Yeah, so she just does it. But she sang that song, and I was there when she did, in a big, big building. And she was in another room, and her voice just filled the whole building, and everybody stopped and listened. And she got perfect scores in her Italian and everything. She just did very, very well with it. But also, it's a girl to her dad, singing to her father to please let her be in love with the man she loves. So it's just really, and it's a beautiful melody. It's just a gorgeous melody. So for all those things, I think it's a beautiful song.
That was O Mio Babbino Quero, sung by Anna Netrebko. Sorry, I'm rubbish with names. But that was beautiful, wasn't it? Beautiful music.
Yeah.
Do you like opera?
I do. I love opera.
Yeah. Have you been to the Met before?
No, I never.
No.
Has been. I mean, I walked past it certainly. And I stood on the stage of Carnegie Hall. But
did you? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually went there to see a concert. And what I found intriguing was before you actually go in, they have these, and it must be sponsorship, but they have these little lozenger boxes that are free. Uh-huh. And it's, you know, those Swiss cough?
Yeah.
Sweets. What are they called?
The guy with the big horn. That
yeah,
goes,
yeah, yeah. Ricolas, right? So there's all these wee boxes with Ricolas so that people don't cough while you're watching the show.
Yeah.
But my first ever experience of the opera, it was a beanbag, and it was in the Bardavon Theatre. I was watching it, and these two homeless women sat down next to me, and it was mobbed.
Oh, dear.
And the two of them. You know, I wasn't angry with them because of probably their situation, but they were smelling.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely rancid.
Oh, God.
And I was sitting next to these two women, and every time there was an applause, there was this waft of horribleness.
I know.
And everybody was apologising to me because they knew it was my first time, and I was just horrible.
Oh, I know. It's a very tough thing. And it's when we lived in Manhattan, I didn't know this at first, but I came to find out that one of my husband's first morning duties was to leave the building and assist the homeless people out of the lobby. And one morning I got up very early and smelled it. And he said, oh, it always smells like that. And that's when he told me that, I get up and I ask him to leave. And yeah, it's too bad.
Now, talking of your husband, your next item you would like to take with you is your wedding ring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, you can see it. It's like a very thin.
Oh, is that it there?
That's it. That's all it is, a real thin band. Yeah.
So it sounds obvious, but why do you want to take your ring with you?
Because I'm really, really very uneasy if I don't have it on. I will not take it off in a play or a film. I won't. I'll find a way to get around it. If I'm not supposed to be married, like if I'm a nun or something like that. Well, nuns wear wedding bands. They're married to Christ, so they do. But if I were to, I've been asked not to wear it, and I find a way around it, I'll put another ring over it.
So
people don't know it's on.
Now, quiz time.
Yeah.
Okay, both of you.
All right.
Okay.
What is the most common word engraved on wedding rings?
Love.
Love.
Love. Is that what you're saying?
Love.
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 Love. No. It is the names of the grooms.
Oh.
What about the bride?
Well, I'm sure that their names are on the male's ring, but it says here the most
girls,
women's wedding rings.
And more women wear wedding bands than men do. A lot of men don't.
Yeah. Now, I've got another quiz, though. What is the most expensive wedding ring ever?
I'm going to say 4 million, Bob.
4 million.
Do you want the amount of money?
Yes, and it's in US dollars.
The
most expensive wedding ring ever.
Well, I'm going to go with $10 million.
$10 million? Okay. Combined, your guesses are wrong. The most expensive ring is valued at this time at $16.26 million United States dollars.
All right.
The chop hard blue diamond ring makes a nice ring to offer to your bride, although a little pricey.
Yeah, I turn that down.
You turn it down?
Yeah, I was afraid it would get caught in the when I was doing dishes.
No, I wouldn't turn it down. I'd take it, sell it, then buy one of the wee thin ones you've got.
You know, though, rings can be hazardous. Jimmy Fallon doing some work around the house, ring gets caught on something.
Well,
totally mangled his finger.
When?
This within the past year or two.
My husband's ring, the last time I took it to the jeweler to be repaired because he had got it caught, because he was a builder, the jeweler said, "Don't come back after this. I won't fix this again." So it's in his jewelry box. Yeah.
Now, that all depends if you're wearing it on your hand, of course. The ring will cause a problem, or potentially could cause a problem.
Mm-hmm.
However, in some parts of India, it is custom to use a bichhia, toe ring, instead of a wedding ring. So there you are.
A what? Oh, toe ring.
Do you take this woman to be your lawful, takes her shoe off, her sandal off, no, wash your feet before you get in there.
Kind of like Cinderella.
But if she... does she have a toe wedding ring?
This is, she wears a glass slipper and he has to put it on. So instead of the glass slipper, you put on a toe ring.
Right.
So if it fits the woman's toe, then wham, bam, bam. She's the one.
I see.
Yeah.
Do you have any toe rings, Elizabeth?
I don't. I'm not big on that.
Toes?
Toes, yeah. I don't have very pretty feet, so I try not to draw attention to them.
Yeah, I don't have pretty feet either. Do you have pretty feet, Mike?
Oh, heavens no.
Mike wears these, what are they called?
Five fingers.
Okay, I just worked with an actor who does also, Brett Owen.
Hmm.
He's a fabulous actor, and he wears those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's comfortable. It's cool.
I've never...
I probably won't. But I'm glad you like...
Actually, I would like I'd like to run in a pair, see what it's like.
It's awesome. To look at them, they're incredibly lightweight, really, really thin material. There's not a whole lot to the sole, but you can run on basically anything, and it's comfortable. And it's like... running barefoot.
Mm-hmm.
They're
do you think it's good really for like the posture and stuff like that to wear them?
It's a little controversial, and I think we talked a little bit about it with a previous guest, but they when they first came out they were saying that there were all these health benefits to running with them, and they would help strengthen your legs and your feet in ways that normal shoes kind of, they coddle your feet and protect them, so some of the muscles get weak, and these will help you to develop those muscles. They made these claims but didn't actually have any science to back them up, and there was a class action lawsuit, and they had to pay customers, anyone who bought the shoes. And I think I could have probably gotten money out of that. Yeah. Whoops. But I really think they do help. And anyways, what was your question? I got off track there in the lawsuit.
Would you run with them? Are they comfortable?
Yeah, they're really comfortable. I probably wouldn't go back to regular shoes. I tend to get blisters and things far more with regular shoes than I have with these.
I tend to wear, as my normal day-to-day shoe, I tend to wear slip-on shoes now.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, shoes with heels and stuff, and I wear them, but I much prefer slip-on shoes.
Yeah,
and you get used to something quite quickly, don't you?
I think so.
Yeah,
change it up.
Anyway, now we are drifting on to different subjects. There,
mm-hmm.
That kind of takes us on to the next and last song that you brought with you.
Our poor listeners. At least they can't see my feet.
The last song you have brought with you to take on your Catskill cabin getaway, Elizabeth, is
Save the Last Dance for Me. Yep.
By who?
By Doc Pomus and Mort Shulman.
And the Drifters.
Well, yeah, they sang it, but Doc Pomus and Mort Shulman wrote it.
Right. And why? What significance does this song have for you?
Everyone loves to sing it, you know, but also Doc Pomus was an important mentor of mine.
He was a mentor of yours?
Yes.
So you know him?
Very well.
Ah, right. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I've read pieces that have been published in very prestige, well, you know, good, like the New York Times, and some of the stuff is directly lifted out of stuff I wrote about him that was published in lesser papers. But, right. You know, this, you know, who cares? It was a long time ago, and
There's been many versions of the Drifters over the years, hasn't there?
You mean of the Save the Last Dance for Me?
No, the Drifters, the band The Drifters.
I don't know.
There have been dozens of band members.
Yeah.
Similar to what was it, the Rolling Stones we were talking about?
Yeah, and what's that other band? I forget the name. But there was loads and loads of bands at that time. The Stylistics, you know, just all different types of bands, mm-hmm. All playing the same type of music, five guys choreographed and, you know, doing the dancing and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a great time, you know. One of the songs that I remember listening to as a kid when it was in the 70s was Kissing in the Back Row of the Museum. Kissing in the Back Row of the Movies on a Set. Remember that?
No.
Ah. No.
Of course, surely. I hadn't been born yet, but...
Surely you must have. Elizabeth, you must have heard that song.
I probably did. I probably did. I just... at the moment, I can't retrieve it, but yeah.
You can dance every dance with the guy who gives you the eye to let him hold you tight. You can smile every smile for the man who held your hand neath the pale moonlight. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Oh, I know that the music's fine, like sparkling wine. Go and have your fun. Laugh and sing. But while we're apart, don't give your heart to anyone. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Baby, don't you know I love you so? Can't you feel it when we touch? I will never, never let you go. I love you oh so much. You can dance, go and carry on till the night is gone and it's time to go.
If he asks, if you're all alone, can he take you home? You must tell him no. 'Cause don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Cause don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Say the last dance for me. Say the last dance for me.
Save the last dance for me by the Drifters. What was the two men that wrote the song?
Doc Pomus and his partner Mort Shubin.
Fantastic, beautiful song. Now, I just want to remind listeners, at any point, if you can, we are a community radio station, and we would love at any point if you could give of yourself in terms of volunteering, or if you could give a donation of any kind to the radio station in order to keep us on the air. That would be fantastic. You can go to www.WGXC90.7FM online or Facebook to facilitate that. And if you can do that, that would be fantastic. Now, Elizabeth, you were telling us that you had a story behind that song.
Well, the story behind it is Doc was a polio victim as a child, and he was a blues singer and saxophone player for a while, but he had to give that up because he could no longer use braces and crutches. He was confined to a wheelchair, and that's when he began songwriting. And he did not consider himself to be lucky in love. And then he met this beautiful young actress and married her. And at their wedding, he couldn't dance with her, you know, because he was confined to a wheelchair. So that's where the song Save the Last Dance for Me comes from. That she should have fun at her wedding and dance with the guests, but just save the last dance for him. So it's a very poignant. He was a really, really important man. And he helped a lot of artists, even if he didn't write with them. He really understood an artist's mind and heart.
Now, time is upon us.
Okay.
And we are coming to the end of the show. It's been wonderful having you on the show.
Thank you.
We could say this a lot to a lot of guests. Could talk for hours.
We're going to have to do like a part two.
Yes, maybe we need to do that, yeah.
Like a whole season of callbacks. Yeah. Two seasons. Five seasons of callbacks.
Oh, no.
Elizabeth.
She's back.
You signed on a contract here. Three shows. Right.
Well, I have a lot more to talk about. So,
Now, one of the things we would like to get your opinion on is we ask our guests a closing question, and that question is mine.
Elizabeth, how do you take your coffee?
Black.
What type of coffee?
I love Gevalia that I make at home, and I actually think it's a good bean from McDonald's. They make a nice cup of coffee. I mean,
you had me until you mentioned that company there.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Henry, and you've been listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations on WGXC, ACRA 90.7 FM. Special thanks to George, Gordon, and Billy from the band White for the theme music, and to everyone at WGXC. Thanks.